Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, December 5th, 2016. The sound you hear is the drum circle at Standing Rock, North Dakota, on Sunday afternoon, after word was delivered that the Corps of Engineers, which I never think of as working on weekends, had announced that it is declining to issue the permit, the easement, sought by Energy Transfer Partners necessary to complete the pipeline under the Cannonball and Missouri Rivers at Lake Oahe. Now, this is a major victory. It may be temporary, but let's enjoy it for a moment. Native Americans, with the support of many immigrant Americans or descendants of immigrants, have launched this protest, the Water Protector Effort, over the last 6 months, and it appears at this moment that at least the Sioux Nation can declare victory and believe that the pipeline will not be damaging its sacred lands or potentially spilling into its critical water sources. Now, this could all change when Trump takes office. It could even change before then. But at least we've seen the government yield to the protests of the people. And for once, we have seen Washington, at least to some extent, acknowledge the rights of the sovereign Sioux Nation. And I think these are important achievements. Politically, they may not be sustainable. And we're going to have to wait and see how it all plays out. So the fundamental news here is that the Corps of Engineers announced that it will not allow the pipeline to be drilled under a dammed section of the Missouri River. But the Corps of Engineers is not canceling the project. They're looking for alternate routes. The best way to complete that work responsibly and expeditiously is to explore alternate routes for the pipeline crossing, said the Army's Assistant Secretary for Civil Works, Joe Ellen Darcy. And that move could mean a lengthy environmental review that has the potential to block the pipeline's construction for months or years. So, we know that Trump owns stock in Energy Transfer Partners. This is a very clear conflict of interest for him. But he's also just ignored that and said that he believes the pipeline should be built and it doesn't have anything to do with his own investment. Now, this is a line that we're probably going to hear over and over again. That Donald Trump only does what's best for the American people. But it's brazenly obvious here that that is not the case. So Dave Archambault II, the Standing Rock tribal chairman, said it's wonderful. And to the supporters there, he said, "You all did that. Your presence has brought the attention of the world." And he said that this means that people no longer have to stay at the camp during the brutal North Dakota winter. And the Corps of Engineers, which had ordered it closed, and today was supposed to be the day that order goes into effect, similar order from the governor of North Dakota. So Archambault said, "It's time now that we move forward. We don't have to stand and endure this hard winter. We can spend the winter with our families." But other people on the scene there at Standing Rock are not taking this at face value. They fear that it is a trick. And when you look at the history of the white man and leaders in Washington telling Native Americans one thing and then screwing them with something else, this is a very understandable concern on their part. Tom Goldtooth, executive director of the Indigenous Environmental Network, said, "Nothing indicates for us to pack up and go home. Our Native people have reason to be distrustful." Tara Huska, a member of the Couchiching First Nation, said, "I celebrate with caution. We know that Trump is coming, and with that, we know the fight will continue." Eloise Brown, a member of the Navajo Nation, "Do not take anything for granted. Do not trust anything they say. I think what happened yesterday was their move to get us to pack up and leave. We're not that stupid." And the Obama administration has to be taken skeptically, because on this effort and on the Keystone XL pipeline, Obama has always hung back, delayed, avoided getting involved. And we'll find out maybe in 6 months, when Jason Leopold does a FOIA on all this, what the back-channel communications were. What did the White House tell the Corps of Engineers to do? But at this point, we can only accept what has been reported. And Energy Transfer Partners is defiant. They issued a statement, and thanks to listener Linda Lewis, who flagged it for me, they said, this is a quote, "The White House's directive to the Corps for further delays is just the latest in a series of overt and transparent political actions by an administration which has abandoned the rule of law in favor of currying favor with a narrow and extreme political constituency. As stated all along, Energy Transfer Partners and the captive company that runs these operations, Sunoco Logistics Partners, are fully committed to ensuring that this vital project is brought to completion and fully expect to complete construction of the pipeline without any additional rerouting in and around Lake Oahe. Nothing this administration has done today changes that in any way." Now, there is informed speculation that Energy Transfer Partners may make the calculation that defying the Corps of Engineers and proceeding with construction, despite the water protectors, and now we have 2,200 Veterans for Peace who have been arriving at Standing Rock over the last 24 hours. They were staging in a nearby state. I know the details, but I'm not going to share them until a few days from now. And it is thought that that pressure, the presence of Hawaiian Congressmember Tulsi Gabbard, that these may have been factors that tipped things in favor of the water protectors, the protesters. But I think that we have to expect that, emboldened by the ascendance of Trump, that people like Kelsey Warren, who has been called out by our friend Charlie Pierce in Texas, are going to believe that Trump is on their side, that they can proceed in, you know, an arrogant and illegal manner, and that they'll get away with it. And, of course, in a job of this size, a couple of $1 million in fines from the federal government is pocket change. It's a cost of doing business. And it would take huge fines for the economics of that to change. Bill McKibben, leader of the 350 movement, issued a statement today. He said that this news it means many things, including that the indigenous activists have won a smashing victory, one that shows what nonviolent unity can accomplish. He traces the history and the ironies that Native American protesters sat down in front of bulldozers and that they were met with attack dogs, and it looked like Birmingham, Alabama, 1963. He went on to say, "Indigenous organizers are some of the finest around the globe. They've been key to everything from the Keystone fight to battling plans for the world's largest coal mine in Australia." And he said, "Time is measured somewhat differently in the dispute between this continent's original inhabitants and the late coming rest of us. For 500 years, half a millennia, the same grim story has repeated itself over and over again. Today's news is a break in that long-running story, a new chapter. It won't set this relationship on an entirely new course. Change never comes that easily. But it won't be forgotten, and it will influence events for centuries to come. Standing Rock, like Little Bighorn or Wounded Knee, or for that matter, Lexington Green and Concord Bridge, now belongs to our history." There's a great recap of these events going back over the last 6 months, written by Kevin Gostola. It's at Shadowproof, and I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. On Friday afternoon, I conducted an interview with two attorneys and elected officials from here in Marin County, California, who had just come back from Standing Rock. Larry Bragman and Ford Green gave me a great interview, and I recommend it to you. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And in this excerpt, Larry Bragman does most of the talking here and explains the legal history, the rights that the Native Americans, the Sioux tribe, have to this area, not just from treaties that we have repeatedly violated from the 19th century, but from laws passed by Congress twice in the latter part of the 20th century, less than 25 years ago. Here's an excerpt from that very interesting conversation with Bragman and Green.
And so just to kind of bring it in a nutshell, as we were walking around the camp, I mentioned to Ford, gee, I wonder if they got subjacent rights. Because they certainly got rights for, they got surface water rights, the Army Corps did and the government did, to flood the surface. But the question remains under property law about what's called subjacent, or essentially what are the underground rights, the mineral rights. And that just was, it just occurred to me, you know, that would be something that we need to check out. And in talking to Phyllis Young, who became our contact with the tribe, I asked her about it. And she said, oh, no, we reserved our mineral rights. And it was at that point that Ford and I, you know, got organized to go to the meeting room at the casino and start doing some legal research with the limited resources we had. And Phyllis had kind of an old dog-eared copy of this congressional bill that was passed in 1958.
Just let me interrupt for a minute, because I was the one that – I mean, it was awesome. Because Larry had this, we were walking around just basically surveying the territory of the camp so that we would know, you know, what was what and where everything was. Larry comes up with this really smart idea, and I go, wow. And then we meet Phyllis. Well, first, then there's the elders meeting. Phyllis was a talker, and afterwards we introduce ourselves, and she invites us to go to the casino. We get up to the casino, and Larry immediately is like on a computer doing independent research, and Phyllis passes me this 85-915, and I start reading it, and it dovetailed very, very well with Larry's theory. And so I started to work at extracting the relevant points out of that, and go ahead on.
So if the tribe
it specifically and unambiguously reserves all mineral rights whatsoever to the tribe,
And that's the language whatsoever,
and that it's explicit in the legislation. So it's not a treaty from 1851. It's not a judicial decision that was handed down by a judge. It is an act of Congress that is seemingly been ignored, and that act of Congress was later reaffirmed in 1992 when Congress passed another compensation act, when it realized that I think the total of $6 million for 56,000 acres might have been inadequate compensation. So there was supplemental compensation given, which reaffirmed all rights and reservations that the tribe had.
I encourage you to listen to the full interview with attorneys Larry Bragman and Ford Green, available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at TuneIn, at iTunes, all the places where the podcast is available, Stitcher, Spreaker. And it's all made possible by people like you who send me small amounts of money in subscription form. People like Grant Gibson and Benny Alto, both in Oregon. Mary Vogt just took out a new annual subscription. Nice going, Mary. Thank you very much. And Billy Cook was online over the weekend bragging about the work that I do, and he backed it up with a new monthly subscription at the $10 level. Billy, thank you very much. I'm really touched by the people who support my work. The holidays are here. If you would like to give a subscription to somebody as a gift, let me know. Just send me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com, and I can help you set that up. And if you're not a subscriber now, I like a guy, I think his name was Larry, that I met at the art show Friday night in Sausalito. Well, come on over to peterbcollins.com and click on the sign-up link. First the menu button, then you click on Become a Subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page. We've got a 24-hour pass for $1. A monthly subscription starts at $5. Our annual subscription is $50. And new annual subscribers who give me a mailing address in the continental U.S. get a bonus book. It's that easy, and I appreciate your support. Here in the Bay Area, it's been somber this weekend. Friday night, there was an awful fire at a warehouse in Oakland, just across the bay from me. It's a warehouse where people were establishing live-work spaces. It was a kind of funky artist's colony, and it was loaded with wood and fuel. The staircase from the first floor to the second was made out of abandoned or recycled wooden pallets. And the building went up in flames, and as of this hour, 36 people have been identified as killed and many more are expected. I think the death toll, I don't want to speculate too much, but it's clear that it can go higher. And this is a confluence of many issues. Oakland is a city that lives on triage. It's underfunded. It is a place where the Oakland Raiders have extorted money at the expense of many people who live at or below the poverty line in this city. And it also reflects the desperate need for low-rent living spaces that people find themselves in, and they're willing to accept a place that doesn't have fire sprinklers, isn't up to code, because they can't afford the alternatives. So it's tragic. I can't really add too much more to that except to say that none of my friends so far has been identified as a victim or related to a victim, but many people are reeling from the loss that occurred. Greg Palast put a blast up on my Facebook page this morning, saying that the claim that Jill Stein has dropped the Pennsylvania recount that was published in the New York Times is false. He said her team will go to court to overturn the insane demand that voters personally post a $1 million bond. The GOP is desperate as Trump's margin drops by 20,000 in Pennsylvania before the recount. Now, I don't have it in front of me, but I think the margin was around 60 or 65,000. This brings it down to the 45,000 vote margin range. And Jill Stein held a news conference outside of Trump Tower in New York today. Maybe she ran into some of the people who are trying to get a gig in the Trump administration. "We are here today," she said, "to stand up for a vote that is accurate, secure, fair, and just, in which every vote counts." The 2016 candidate has raised more than $7 million to fund recounts in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. She said, "It's clear that the fix was in against a verified vote in the state of Pennsylvania. So we are now moving to federal court to ask the court to please stand up for our constitutional right to vote." Well, a federal judge in Michigan did just that on Sunday, and he told Michigan authorities to begin the recount at noon today, ignoring a statutory requirement that they wait 2 days in case there are challenges to the request for a recount. And this is an interesting move by a federal judge who was appointed by Barack Obama, and it'll be interesting to see how that recount proceeds. We know that there are tens of thousands of undervotes, and there's only a 10,704 vote margin in Michigan. Those undervotes are concentrated in Wayne County in Detroit, where it is believed that there was some kind of a game played with the optical scanners so that a vote for Hillary didn't register, but a vote for Trump did. Because these undervotes show that people voted for Senate and Congress and down-ticket items, but did not cast a vote for president. And for tens of thousands, the number I've heard is 90,000, to have done that is questionable behavior, at minimum. So it is interesting to see all this go forward. And, of course, Donald Trump, who said that millions of people voted fraudulently for Hillary, is trying to, you know, use his legal teams to block the recounts in these three states. And he is so concerned that he is tweeting about it. He falsely said the Green Party just dropped its recount suit in Pennsylvania and is losing votes in Wisconsin recount. Just a Stein scam to raise money. And at her news conference, Jill Stein properly noted that Donald Trump really should have nothing to be afraid of. If he believes he won this election, then why would a legitimate recount be challenged? She said, "We are here to urge Donald Trump that there is nothing to be afraid of. If you believe in democracy, if you believe in the credibility of your victory, put down your guards." Now, the recount and challenge to the governor's race in North Carolina is over after the guy who thought he had rigged the race for himself had to admit defeat. Republican Governor Pat McCrory finally conceded to Democratic challenger Roy Cooper. And this was a very protracted battle where they pulled out all the stops. It's like Karl Rove back in 2012 when he said, "Hey, don't declare this over yet. My rigging actions haven't kicked in." Well, I mentioned that the New York Times got it wrong. The headline in Saturday's paper, actually in Sunday's paper, says, Stein drops Pennsylvania recount effort, ending a long-shot push against Trump. That makes it fake news in the New York Times, right? We're hearing a lot about fake news these days, and the Times and other mainstream media outlets are going into overdrive to link Mike Flynn, who is the nominated national security advisor for Donald Trump, to link him to what is considered to be a hoax and false fake news about a story that has been dubbed Pizzagate. Now, I want to concede that I have not had the time to fully investigate Pizzagate, but it centers around allegations from John Podesta's emails that coded language was used to describe parties where underage children were available for sex. Now, this is not new to Washington. Dennis Hastert was a pedophile who's now in federal prison. He was the Republican Speaker of the House. And when he was permitted to plead guilty to essentially structured transactions, money laundering, when he paid off one of his victims, well, the corporate media and the political establishment didn't pursue the obvious, and that is that Dennis Hastert didn't stop buggering little boys or young boys when he became Speaker of the House. In fact, Sybelle Edmonds says there are videotapes of his sexual adventures. So I don't know about the Pizzagate story, and I want to put this out to my listeners. If you have seen credible sources that cover Pizzagate, please email me, peter@peterbcollins.com, and paste them in or link the stories so that I can pursue this. As you know, I have been I don't want to call myself courageous, but I have taken some risks in reporting on pedophile scandals in the past, and I'm not afraid to do so again. But I need credible sourcing, and I invite you to provide that if you've seen it. Now, in the case of Mike Flynn, 6 days before the election, he put out a tweet about what the New York Times calls a fake news story and a hoax that claimed the police and prosecutors in New York had found evidence linking Hillary Clinton and much of her senior campaign staff to pedophilia, money laundering, perjury, and other felonies. You decide, Flynn wrote when he sent that link out in a tweet. Now, this is attracting renewed attention because on Sunday, a man fired a rifle inside the Washington pizza joint that was the subject of these stories. And it's called Comet Ping Pong on the northwest sector of Washington. And a guy named Ed Welch, wow, I had an uncle named Ed Welch, but this guy's from Salisbury, North Carolina. He showed up with a gun, fired some shots into the place, and has been arrested. So it's murky. And again, if you have information on Pizzagate, please send it my way. And whatever I find credible, I will pass along to you in these podcasts. Well, the Twitter maniac was at it again Sunday morning. He sent out a series of tweets, Trump did, saying that essentially threatening American companies that send jobs abroad. And this is frustrating because on the one hand, I kind of support what Trump is doing, shaming corporate America into being good American corporate citizens. And he says that he would impose tariffs on companies that ship jobs overseas and send products back to the United States. The problem with this, of course, is that tweets don't give you enough information. They simply, you know, state an issue, offer a point of view, and we're all supposed to guess that he's actually going to do something about it. We're also hearing that Trump has expanded the search for Secretary of State. And considering that he was, had a short list of Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney, guardedly, I would say that's good news. John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah and a former ambassador to China, who is a relatively rational Republican, apparently has been added to the list. And that's, well, in this context, that's good news. Scary what makes good news these days. Trump needs some adult diplomatic support. Now, we can't tell if this was conscious disruption or just Trump being Trump, but there is a big diplomatic crisis now because he accepted a phone call from the leader of Taiwan. The phone call was to congratulate Trump for his election. But this doesn't play well in Beijing, where we have hewn to a one-China policy, and we essentially ignore Taiwan in favor of Beijing. Now, I am open to rethinking this policy, but for a president-elect to be disrupting the status quo before he even takes office, and without any kind of a plan, no infrastructure, no diplomatic support, this is highly reckless. And this is the kind of thing that we are confronting as Americans for up to 4 years, or God forbid, 8 years. Our friend Justin Frank, who wrote Bush on the couch and then Obama on the couch, well, he sent out a brief, almost Twitter-length review or analysis of Donald Trump. He said this past weekend, some Trump observers expressed surprise when the president-elect couldn't stop himself from tweeting his reaction to a Saturday Night Live skit in which he couldn't stop himself from tweeting. It is funny. He goes on, they shouldn't have been surprised. Trump's tweets are best understood as originating from a primitive psychic space beyond the reaches of a restraining self-consciousness. By continuing to tweet, Trump consciously lets everyone know exactly how thin-skinned he can be. Some say his tweets are strategic, aimed at keeping us from noting both his reactionary cabinet appointments and the recount movement afoot in three states. To me, he confirms his severely compromised attention span, keeping alive previous questions about his ability to read or process information other than reactively. Nicely said, Justin. Trump has chosen a man who acknowledged he has no experience or skills for such an assignment, and he has named Dr. Ben Carson as the Secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. That's really bad news for my brother, who is a regional administrator for HUD in the Midwest. Also, people are recognizing in Washington, now that the giddiness of the Republican sweep has started to wear off, that the phrase repeal and replace Obamacare isn't going to work. So we're now hearing repeal and delay. So there's going to be this dramatic move early in the Trump administration to repeal Obamacare, but the repeal will not be effective for 2 to 3 years. They want to push it past the next midterm elections so that people don't experience how bad it is. But this could be self-destructive because the Republicans clearly have the votes to repeal Obamacare, but they don't have the votes in the Senate to replace it. And while Obamacare was passed by the Democrats under what's called budget reconciliation, and that only requires 51 votes, not 60, any effort to replace the elements of Obamacare with, for example, health savings accounts and other approaches requires 60 votes in the Senate. And so reality is settling in here, and we'll see just how far that goes. Interesting move announced today. The conservative Prime Minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, announced that he will visit Pearl Harbor, becoming the first Japanese leader to go to the site 75 years after the attack on December 7th in 1941. He will visit during President Obama's last presidential vacation to Hawaii on December 26th and 27th, and it's a kind of payback for Obama's honoring the victims of our atomic bomb in Hiroshima when he visited there over the summer. In Italy, the Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has announced that he'll follow through on his promise to resign. He had sponsored a big reform ballot measure, an initiative, and it failed miserably. So Renzo has said the no won in an incredibly clear way. I assume all of the responsibility. My experience of government ends here. And he was planning to tender his resignation this afternoon. Another man's been released from Guantanamo, Shaki Awad Balzuher, a native of Yemen, who had been imprisoned without trial or charge for 14 years. He is going to be sent to Cape Verde because we say we can't send people back to Yemen. And he, of course, was never charged, and they had accused him of things he was not responsible for. I also learned today that New York Governor Cuomo's blacklist of companies that support boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel has issued its first blacklist. There are no American companies or individuals listed, and if you appear on the list, you're banned from contracting with the state of New York. The 13 corporations are all foreign entities, and to date, none of them has a contract with the state of New York, so this is a toothless expression. But it is ugly, and it is a clear violation of my First Amendment rights to speak critically of the state of Israel and to use my economic power, limited as it is, to advance my opinions. There's a powerful op-ed that I'm linking to in the show file for today's podcast. It's in the New York Times and written by the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Georgia here in the United States. And tomorrow, Georgia intends to execute a man named William Sally for a conviction of murder from 1990. And former Justice Fletcher offers a very strong argument that Mr. Sally is going to be executed despite the fact that he missed a filing deadline for a federal appeal of his case by 8 days. And in Georgia, there is no guarantee of counsel for condemned prisoners. And that's what former Justice Fletcher takes to task here. He said he cites a case that he voted on in 1999 and said that sham of a proceeding is one of the most deplorable vignettes in Georgia's legal history. But a majority of my fellow justices were less moved, and the court decided 4-3 that people with death penalty convictions have no right to counsel at the critical post-conviction stage, a ruling that is still in force today. Well, I appreciate that Mr. Fletcher spoke up. He has voted in favor of executing individuals, so he's not a softie on capital punishment. He's standing up for justice, and I applaud that. And finally today, Barack and Michelle Obama presided over their final Kennedy Center honors event. And I am thrilled because Mavis Staples, along with Al Pacino, James Taylor, pianist Martha Argerich, and members of the Eagles, were singled out for honor. And I go way back with the Staples singers. When I was a young buck hosting a talk show in Chicago when Nixon was president, Pop Staples used to call me in the early morning hours, about the time Donald Trump tweets now. And as a result, I got to meet Mavis and Cleo and the other members of the family. And I am in love with Mavis Staples' voice. I've been able to catch up with her backstage a few times over the years. And she pretends to remember me. Maybe she does. But I just think that she's one of the most amazing singers, always under-recognized. And for the Obamas to see that and make their final pass at honoring American performers to include Mavis Staples, well, I've linked to one of my favorite tunes by the Staples Singers. I can't play it for you because of music licensing rules and YouTube, but I've linked to the YouTube file for Let's Do It Again, and I hope you'll click on it and turn it up good and loud and listen to that beautiful voice of Mavis Staples. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.